couldn't possibly remember.
Possibly be bothered to care. He's probably forgotten about the safe house bit. Yeah. It's a forgettable movie, as much as I kind of like it.
I have no response to that.
We're rolling, right?
We are rolling.
Yeah, I figured we were. This is fun. We don't have a movie to banter about. We just have lists to banter about. Any lessons learned from the first episode of this countdown? I know we had some kind of fun overlaps already.
Yeah, let's look at that. We can talk about that. So we had a total of 12, it looks like, so far, that are in a crossover at some point. Okay. Only one crossover in that first set of 20, and that was Cavalry, which was both on Dalton and Dustin's lists. I'm still Arthur.
I'm still Dustin.
I am still Dalton, also the liker of Cavalry.
I think so far, Dalton and I have the most crossover.
That kind of makes sense to me.
But it's pretty close between you and Dustin. Well, you and I, Dalton and Arthur, have 5.
Okay.
Dalton and Dustin have 4.
Okay.
Arthur and Dustin have 1 so far. And then there's 2 that have a 3-way crossover.
You know, we predicted that we'd be very close, you and I, more so than you and I and Dalton.
Did we?
I think that's what you call.
I think we've landed on me being a middle ground between your proclivity for foreign, short, and experimental, and your newer hot take Zeitgeist.
Yeah,
mindset.
My Zeitgeisty picks, my 80s and 90s classics picks.
Currency bias picks, yeah.
Yeah.
But we did have Portrait of a Lady on Fire, which will probably be up on all 3 lists, as well as The Shining, I think,
gotcha.
Was said would be on all 3 lists.
Okay, so, I think so, yeah.
But that's, that's kind of a quick recap of those stats. We had 59 unique movies on that section.
That's really fun. It's exciting that we only had one overlap.
Solid list of movies right there.
I got a feeling the further up we go, though, the more
you think overlap.
Yeah,
more consensus.
A lot more of that, yeah.
We'll see.
So, well, with that, let's begin then with number 80. This is number 80. I begin first. I guess we'll do the same pattern we've been doing.
Sure.
In case someone like marathons these episodes together.
Have fun.
God.
Hopefully they're listening at 2x speed.
Yeah.
But if they are, number 80 for me is Alfred Hitchcock's 1943 Shadow of a Doubt. I really, really love Shadow of a Doubt. And it is one of those sort of undersung, undersold Hitchcock films. I love the Dracula of it. I love Joseph Cotten's performance in it. I love the way in which the doubling is not with real doubles, but with an Uncle Charlie and his nephew, Charlene Charlie. And it's just fantastic. And I also think it proves itself to be an Urtex as well. I'm thinking about Stoker from Park Chan-wook.
It does depend where you're putting the
surname. Or Chan-wook Park.
Yeah, yeah.
That particular director.
Both are acceptable.
Who I am addressing. I love that movie very much by him. So
and this is sort of its Urtext,
it
right?
It is its Urtext, yeah. You know, amongst its Urtext. And it's just beautifully shot. The use of his train, the way in which Joseph Cotten appears, the mystery itself. It's a movie without a MacGuffin, unless MacGuffin is to figure out who is really Uncle Charlie, what's he about?
What the mystery is itself.
So there's not like an object, obscure or desirous. And so it's interesting for that. And so, yeah, I love Shadow of a Doubt. It is one of my favorite Hitchcock movies ever. Easily alongside, this could have been instead North by Northwest. It could have been Notorious, but I'm taking at this point to go ahead and put Shadow of a Doubt.
You got more Hitch on your list coming up?
I do have more Hitch. Neither one of those two movies, but yes.
I figured probably neither of those two or you wouldn't have mentioned them.
But yeah. I got more Hitch coming. Okay. So there you go, dear listeners. Number 80 for you, Arthur. Go.
My number 80 is going to kick off what's going to be a pretty heavy, I think, horror-weighted section of this marathon. But it is 2002's The Ring from Gore Verbinski, adapted from Ringu. Which really kicked off this J-horror Americanized reboot fad that took over in the 2000s. And still, we get a bit here and there, but it was really that, The Grudge, and then a handful of others that came out in the following decade. Pulse is another one. I think there's one about a camera as well, kind of a Say Cheese and Die type thing, if I'm not mistaken. But I mean, visually aesthetic, I think can top some of the stuff that happens in The Ring, from the cursed video itself and the bizarre, surreal horror imagery that is bestowed upon that, to Samara coming out of that TV, dripping wet. Still one of the great effects, I think, and such a spooky, that weird spider walk thing, which has been emulated time and time again.
You know what I think about a lot is the horse on the boat.
Oh, yeah.
I just think about that a ton.
The one that jumps off?
Yeah. That's freaky.
It really, I mean, narratively might have some hiccups, but I think just as far as tone and aesthetic, Verbinski's just nailing it home. For me, it stands out. It's embroiled in my head, and that is The Ring at number 80. Dalton, kicking it off, number 80, what do you got?
I have Sean Baker's Tangerine.
Nice.
Thank you. A film we've covered on this show before. A film that, to me, like, really holds true the promise of the digital era democratizing film production with its, you know, its pedigree of being shot on an iPhone, its non-professional actors, really kind of a non-traditional way of making a movie. And it is full of heart and humanity, and it centers voices that aren't. And this is such an interesting thing about Sean Baker as a filmmaker. I've only seen this film in the Florida Project, but his investment in telling stories that are not his own, which is a pretty perilous thing to do if you're going to be a filmmaker. I've heard some rumblings that Sean might be problematic, to put it like gently, I guess. I've heard tell that maybe he's faved some reactionary type stuff on Twitter. I don't know. I know. I know Red Rocket is very much about sort of our current moment or the Trump era.
Yeah.
So at the very least, he's interested in this aspect of American society. But again, I'm going to go ahead and let Tangerine stay on the list. I don't know enough about, again, these are just some things that friends have told me, and I've not done my due diligence on ferreting out what I needed to know. But again, I think this film really is propulsive. It's funny. It's heartwarming. It's everything you want from, you know, kind of character study drama, but it's propulsive in a way that a character dramas just usually aren't. That sort of camera on the street, iPhone, Steadicam that's deployed throughout just gives it such life and such beauty. It really is a profound film, and I think Kiki Rodriguez and Maya Taylor are just absolutely phenomenal in it, and really give excellent performances as just these two sex workers trying to make it in Los Angeles and trying to navigate a world that wants to kill them, for lack of any other way to put it. That is number 80, Tangerine, for me.
I like that movie a lot. I read a little bit about it today, in fact. It's mentioned pretty detailed in that Larson book. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah, it's a great movie. Great movie. Like it a lot. And just the fact it's all shot on iPhone is just incredible.
It
so,
blows your mind. I mean, yeah, you can attach all kinds of lenses to an iPhone and turn to a real camera, but still, it's just a weird thing to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. All right, well, moving on to number 79. So number 79 for me is another avant-garde short. So here are some quick fun facts about this short. This is not like I'm going to give you fun facts, you're going to guess it. I'm just going to give you fun facts.
Okay.
11 minutes long, shot for a budget of $97 American in 1928, which is still almost nothing. I mean, you know, it's not a Hollywood budget by any stretch.
1920s money, that's still like, what, a grand?
Yeah, maybe.
I don't know what $27 like, is, or $97 is in the 20s.
It's probably like $1,000 movie, yeah.
Yeah.
It's like, so we could have made this.
Yeah.
Yeah, we could have, you know, pooled money for 2 weeks and figured out a way to put this together. It is a film, there's two directors, but one of the film directors wrote the first draft of the Frankenstein screenplay.
No kidding.
Yeah. Robert Flory and Slavoj Vorkapic's The Life and Death of 9413, a Hollywood extra. And it is the urtext of the someone who goes to Hollywood and wants to make it big, but shot in this expressionistic style.
Isn't this cool?
It's an incredible 11 minutes of your life. And I'm easily available on YouTube, super, super influential, and just a powerful little movie. But Life and Death of 9413, a Hollywood extra. Again, Slavoj Vorkapic and Robert Flory. Robert Flory is the guy who wrote the Frankenstein bit. He later went on to do a lot of work in television. He wrote and directed a bunch of episodes of The Twilight Zone, I believe, and some other things like that. So he had a career after this. But as he began his career, he was doing some fun experimental cinema. And 9413 is one of those examples of that. Moving on, what's your number 79, Arthur?
Speaking of people searching for stardom, My number 79 is a 2014 little dark horse from Damien Chazelle called Whiplash.
Yeah, okay.
Starring Miles Teller and J.K. Simmons. I dig stories of obsession and chasing that dragon that is fame or a dream or an accomplishment. And I don't know that anything is as impactful as Miles Teller just going to town on some drums for 90 minutes while J.K. Simmons demon yells at him.
Am I rushing or dragging, Arthur?
In this pact with the devil that is this tale of trying to be the best and leaving a mark and making a name for yourself and blazing a trail and the challenges that come with that and the deals that have to be made and the sacrifices and the hurts that go along with it. I think it's Chazelle's best film to date. And it's tight. It knows what it's about. It's always impactful. Incredible sound design. If you look at the movie from a technical aspect, the sound design, sound mixing, the way it's shot, those drum sequences are just really incredible. So I think for that alone, it's worth a watch because it is just a really well-constructed piece of film. And the story is powerful as well. And so it is Whiplash at 79. Dalton?
My number 79 is also about a young student finding their way in a highly competitive field. It is Julia Ducournau's Raw, the story of a veterinarian student in France who has specific and insatiable tastes. This movie is... God, what is it not about? It feels like it's about so many things. Mm-hmm. I think mostly it's about being a young woman, but it definitely... speaks to a lot of issues, a lot of themes. It looks incredible. It is got a vibe like nothing else, except for, I don't know, maybe some other Julia Ducournau movies that I might talk about later.
Right.
I don't know. I think this movie rules. We've talked about it on the show before. I know we were all just kind of blindsided by this movie when we checked it out. It's something I still think about. It's just the party, the final reveal of this movie is... such an impactful final scene. It really does just like send an already excellent movie away, sends it on home as a masterpiece. Like, truly, it's an excellent movie, and you get to that final scene, you're like, wow, what a picture. Yeah, this movie rules, and I won't say much more because I think the experience of watching this is a huge part of falling in love with it. It's Raw.
Very good, very good. So we have done number 79. We're down to number 78, and we continue with...
That was my first visit to France. Is that...
I think it is.
Have you gone to France yet?
I've gone to France.
I thought
sure.
So.
I've been to France.
Yeah, I've been to France.
We already went to France last week?
Yeah.
Okay.
We did Gaspar already.
That's so, right. We did Gaspar on yours. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So we're actually visiting the country of Iran now.
Okay.
By way of France, of all places. Marjane Satrapi's another student film, coming of age film, Persepolis.
Yeah. Okay.
And so love Persepolis, great little animated film. I think it's the second animated film on my list so far. And there's a couple, third, because we did Akira already. But anyway, it's a great movie. I don't know what else you want to say about it other than it is a coming of age story told in an animated style that is very punk. The movie is just so punk rock, Iranian punk rock, as though that is a thing. And it is. And just what it means to grow up in the time before the Shah, or of the Shah, I guess, and then finally the Ayatollah, and figuring out your place in the world and who you are, identity, and all of the cultural politics that go alongside that. Persepolis is just an incredible film, a great watch, and I recommend it to anybody. So that's number 78 for me. What's 78 for you, Arthur?
Number 78 for me is another war movie. So we got to Platoon last time, and this time we're going to go back to World War II. We're going to talk about Saving Private Ryan.
Okay.
Steven Spielberg. This is a movie that I don't know why, but over the last 5 or 10 years, I just find myself thinking about it a lot. When I think about war movies, I think about Spielberg, I think about kind of everything he's done. It's just something about Saving Private Ryan. I think it is. It's just led by a strong ensemble, and Tom Hanks taking the charge there. It's just filled with a number of memorable moments. And just has this somehow affirming message in it, I think, of life and a life worth living and being the best you can be for others. And, you know, putting it in this kind of that hellscape opening as they exit those boats on the beach, and just the immediacy of what Spielberg puts us into, two guys battling back and forth, and one guy stabbing another with a knife, saying, shh, 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 shh.
Oh, yeah.
It's a moment me and a friend talk about a lot.
When you brought up Saving Private Ryan, was the first thing I thought of.
It's just got all those moments. And it has Vin Diesel getting picked off by a sniper, which I've always been a fan of. especially early in my not liking Vin Diesel days. But I've come around on the guy. But there was a period where I didn't like him.
There's
an
opening sequence on Mark Cousins' story of film where he talks. I mean, that's the opening sequence. He talks about Ireland, the coast of Ireland where they shot this at. Yeah. And it's a lie that tells the truth. And he talks about it being hell above and the water below, and his slow, lilting Irish accent, just sort of the hypnotic nature of film and the beauty of what it is. And he uses that moment to introduce the entire scope of why movies are beautiful. So Saving Private Ryan's great.
That beach landing is a gargantuan achievement in action filmmaking. Yeah. Mm-hmm. It boggles the mind. And it's weird that it's a World War II movie that doesn't like revel in anything resembling moral superiority. It's a movie that just says war's bad.
Yeah.
It's not, it is bad for the soul.
Yeah.
It's toxic. Yeah. And I think it's a great pick, man.
So that's where I'm at 78. It is Saving Private Ryan.
What's your 78, Dalton?
My 78 is a little film called Singin' in the Rain.
Oh, yes.
Hey. The lone musical on my list, which I feel...
We'll be seeing it again.
I feel bad about. I wanted to find more room for musicals on this list. But there's only a few that like really live in my heart. Grease just narrowly got edged out of this list. I think it's on my 102, 103. That's a musical that is kind of baked into me. I think about that movie a ton. It's just a movie I watched a lot as a kid. I think about Across the Universe, which I think is a really stellar jukebox musical. Mm-hmm. And that's sort of why I picked Singin' in the Rain. It is because of its status as a jukebox musical. You know, it repurposes a bunch of old musical numbers from other movies and sort of tells a tale about, boy, aren't musicals cool. Mm-hmm. And they're awesome. And I think Singin' in the Rain is a movie that, like, just as a thesis statement for a movie, aren't musicals cool, does a really good job of illustrating that point. It's got its problems. You know, we talked about its sort of historical issues with this film on the episode we covered it, two or three years ago now? I don't know, not that long ago. We covered it and kind of talked about its just straight up plagiarism that takes place in the film, but that's sort of hidden in its jukebox musical status, right? It's a tricky question to untangle. But anyway, those things said, it just really is astonishing. And Gene Kelly is a damn movie star. Everybody in this movie is a movie star. It really does come down to make them laugh for me.
Cosmo.
What a sequence, man.
Yeah, give me that Stanley Donen doing that bit, running in a circle on the floor all day, every day.
It's great. That's just movie magic.
Yeah.
More than the sort of the titular number that everybody thinks of. It's make them laugh for me. 78, Singin' in the Rain. Dustin?
No? Oh, yeah, you were 76. Yeah, I was looking ahead. You're right, 78. We're doing 77
now. Well, now that you're looking at 77, what is it?
Number 77 for me is 2008's The Dark Knight.
Okay.
Ooh, cool.
Okay.
I like Batman a lot.
All right.
It is the Batman movie that made it.
It is the superhero movie other than Spider-Man 2 that I think belongs on this kind of list.
Yeah.
I think there are not very many movies in that genre that make a case for themselves. And I think that's one that does a pretty good job.
Now, give me a little time to think on it more, and The Batman may supplant this. But I need to have more time to think on it before that happens.
Batman's gothy, heterosexual camp does sort of...
I kind of love it.
It is sort of magical.
Man.
But why do you like Christopher Nolan's ultra-grim, ultra-realistic... I guess it's not ultra-grim, but grim.
It's grim. Heath Ledger.
Yeah, it's Heath.
Heath Ledger is a big part of it. I think the crime noir of it, I really like a lot. You know, the thing about The Batman is very much sort of like a film noir private investigator kind of story. This is just like more like The Wire in this sense. It's just the overall corruption of the Heat. Yeah, Heat would be a good example as well. Just the whole city is broke.
The Urtext.
and trying to figure this kind of stuff out. And so they're negotiating quite a bit of corruption on a sort of a systemic level in the film. Also, I love the 9/11 Patriot Act conversation of it all about this whole idea of surveillance and monitoring and security and, you know, privacy and those kinds of questions as well. I find it to be a very thoughtful movie. Christian Bale's good. You know, he's not the stellar performance center. He's not even the third most stellar performer in this. But that being said, yeah, I just enjoy it a lot. And it's a movie that I never get bored watching. And I think that integration of IMAX 70 mil with the 35 millimeter film is also really, really seamless. And just really, really works. And so a lot of it in terms of style works a lot for me as well. So for me, 77 is The Dark Knight. What is your 77, Mr. Arthur Gordon?
77 for me is a movie that as I was getting into movies more in high school, really stuck with me. And it is Tombstone.
I'm your Huckleberry.
Yeah. Yes. I'm just... great performances across the board, great lines.
Val Kilmer's best performance, period.
Easily.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Hands down.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I'm drawn to movies with big characters, fun scripts, kind of epic stories, and the kind of romanticization of, I think, these brothers and Doc is a really fun way to tell that story. It's just beautiful in a lot of ways. Again, a lot of it is, I think, Val Kilmer and just what he does with Doc throughout that movie and where Doc's arc takes him in that. But even, you know, Wyatt's good. You know,
yeah.
Kurt's good.
Kurt's getting it.
He's so good. Sam Elliott. Our loved Bill Paxton as well.
Michael Biehn doing great, giving great bad guy.
Yeah. It's just, it's a lot of fun. It's one I watched a lot when I really started getting into movies. I've watched it probably every day for a long period of time.
One of two movies I had on my iPod in high school. The other one was Zoolander.
that's a spectrum right there.
That's a mood board right there. but yeah, 77 is Tombstone.
I'm an oak, all right. Very good. Number 77 for you, Dalton.
Number 77 is a movie that lives in my DNA. It is 1992's Terminator 2 by one Jimmy Cameron. I love this movie. It's a movie about dads. It's a movie about humanity's inhumanity to one another. It is a movie about our likely inevitable self-destructive tendencies as a species. I just think it's an incredible film. And it is a high watermark in action filmmaking. Got maybe one of the best kid performances of its decade, if not of an even larger time frame. I think... God love him. Poor Edward Furlong gave his childhood for this movie, and he probably deserved to get to be a real person. But I'm glad he was the John Connor that we all needed. We needed that dumb little shithead to be the center of this movie, and it just works. I mean, yeah, Terminator is a fine sort of horror thriller, sci-fi horror thriller, but this high concept science fiction action family drama about robots. is really just a kind of lovely piece of movie making.
Man, that thumbs up at the end makes me cry every time.
Yeah, I know now why you cry. That shit rules.
Oh, man.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But so does Stand on One Leg. Mm-hmm. Okay. The beating up the bozos. Yeah, it's great. Like all the My Bodyguard stuff is very funny. The sequence rescuing Sarah from the she's already on her way out of the hospital on her own accord, but the sequence in the mental asylum is like one of my favorite like chase sequences in movies. The whole sequence of getting in and getting out, it's stellar. And then the end of this movie is just 45 minutes of practical effects and CG working together to deliver a really kind of incredible but grounded set pieces. There's a reason that they keep trying to make more of this movie, and there's a reason they keep failing. It is sort of lightning in a bottle in some ways. It's great performances all the way across the board. Probably Arnold's best. Definitely he's got a movie on my list ranked higher. But I think it's maybe his best performance. One of my favorite performances of his.
Yeah.
And again, I think Linda Hamilton is, again, her, Edward Furlong and Arnold just like turning a truly stellar three-hander of, again, it's a family drama road trip for half of the movie, at least. It does mm-hmm. so many things, and yet is so kind of singular in its action chops. I love this movie. It's one that has been with me for as long as I can remember watching movies. Mm. It is T2, Judgment Day.
T2 will be back.
Mm. It won't make it back on mine, but it could have. Yeah, I like that movie a lot. So number 76 is where I get a 2021 movie. And so there are some super new movies that do make the list. And it's a movie that I have been talking about quite a bit in public. And that is Nicolas Cage starring in Pig. Mm. I love Pig.
I'm so happy Pig made your list. We'll talk about Pig again.
Oh, will we? Okay, good.
Yeah, hell yeah, man.
I'm glad to hear that because Pig is absolutely incredible. It is an anti-John Wick movie, and I like that about
it. What a first feature.
What a first feature, yeah. And yeah, to get Nick Cage for that, and all the other performances are great. I don't have to say anything more about it at this point since we are going to talk about it a bit more later. But I love the idea of this sort of Portland food culture thing as the backdrop of the Den of Thieves. The Assassin's Guild is just, you know, high-level gourmet cooking, which is kind of fascinating as a backdrop. The way in which it sets up all your expectations and then upsets them. It's an incredible movie, and yeah, one of my favorite movies of ever, and even though I only saw it for the first time this last year. So Pig from 2021 is my 76. What's your 76, Arthur?
Speaking of feature debuts, mine is also a feature debut from one Ari Aster, and that is Hereditary. Mm. Nice. Which is just, I think, a lights-out horror movie. The craft and the skill that Aster brings, I think, is just very mature and very smart and very clever. The use of miniatures in this movie, I think, is really fascinating and adds complexities to what's taking place here. I'm just a fan of spooky haunted houses, and I think a lot about this movie. I think a lot about Toni Collette. In this movie, I think a lot about her just going above and beyond at every turn to put in one of, I think, the great horror performances and one of the great performances maybe the last decade in
not
general.
Not giving her an Oscar nomination.
It was embarrassing.
It's criminal.
Yeah, yeah. It was an embarrassment.
What a bankrupt organization.
Yeah, 100%. Correct. Yeah. But man, and just Gabriel Byrne, literally. And telephone poles, it makes you think about those in new ways. Man, it just works for me on every level. I think it is just such a lights out debut for Aster. And it earns so much goodwill off that movie that I'm always going to be excited to see what he does next based off that one instance alone. And so it is Hereditary for me.
Very cool, very cool. What is your 75, or 76 there? Sorry, 76. We're on 76, Dalton. Sorry.
My number 76 is a film that I watched kind of like in bits and pieces a lot growing up, but is a film that I only kind of really grew to find my love for when we covered it for this show, and it is Catherine Bigelow's Point Break. Jimmy and Catherine back to back on purpose. That is sort of how the list worked out. But I just think Point Break is, again, another high watermark in action cinema.
Yeah.
It's so much more grounded than something like T2. It's definitely a leaner, meaner action joint. It's a different kind of action movie, but it again is a story that, sure, it's a story of cops and undercover work, but it's also a love story about three people who are all into each other and can't really figure out how to make that work because they all come from different backgrounds and have different baggages and have different goals and different needs and wants. But also there's an incredible foot chase and also people jump out of airplanes and surf and shoot at each other and scream and shoot pistols into the sky because they can't take down the one person they're supposed to take down. I love this movie. I think it's great. I think it's gay as hell. It is a spectacular film. It is Catherine Bigelow's Point Break.
I like Point Break a lot. Very cool. We're moving on to number 75.
Hey, you did it.
I did. I got it right this time. Number 75 for me is my only entry from Joel and Ethan Coen.
Your only Coens.
My only Coens. And it is No Country for Old Men.
Ah.
I like that movie a lot. It was one of the first movies I watched when I really started to get serious to caring about movies, like professionally starting caring about movies and started thinking about this whole possible endeavor of going into film studies.
Oh, wow.
And
okay.
So I caught it that year in 2007 in the theater, and I remember being bewildered by it. The first time, and I'd seen other movies that had ambiguous endings and whatnot, but I was really just taken aback by it. And then every time I've watched it, I've just found it to be deeply, deeply rich. All the performances are great. Coens are great, and Javier Bardem's Anton Chigurh character is one of the nightmare fuels of my life. I mean, he's just terrifying to me. And so for me, 75 is No Country for Old Men. Moving on, what is your 75 there, Arthur?
It is another haunted house movie. It's The Conjuring. I dig The Conjuring quite a bit. Mm-hmm. Its ability to tap into almost the 70s aesthetic while being a very modern film. This great cast with Patrick Wilson and Vera Farmiga as Ed and Lorraine Warren, which kickstarts unintentionally Warner Brothers' most successful cinematic universe somehow.
Weird.
But it's just, it relies heavily on atmosphere and mood, and James Wan landing an R rating without nary a curse word in sight is an impressive feat.
Mm-hmm. Next to no blood.
Booby or PP in sight. It's all spooks all the time.
It is just so scary that we cannot let children see this.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love it so
pretty
much.
Pretty badass.
It's a baller move. And so it's a strong benchmark, I think, for haunted house movies and what they can be and how to properly elicit fear without relying on cheap jump scares and tactics like that, while also giving you characters with heart and passion. And I don't have much to say about the real Ed and Lorraine, but I love the Conjuring cinematic universe's Ed and Lorraine quite a bit. So there we go. It's The Conjuring.
All right,
75.
What's your 75 there, Dalton?
My number 75 is Spike Jones and oh my God, I'm blanking on his name. It's
Charlie Kaufman.
Thank you. Spike Jones and Charlie Kaufman's adaptation. Thank you so much, Arthur. Charlie will come up again on this list, I think. I'm pretty sure he comes up again. I'll have to double check my numbers. I think one of his directorial features made it pretty high on my list. It came close if it didn't end up making the cut. I'll have to double check my data. But this film is so unlike anything else. Is a movie about making movies that is also a movie about adapting art into another type of art, and is a movie about commerce versus artistic expression, is about integrity versus relatability. It's about being yourself versus getting out of your own way. I think it's such an interesting movie, and is also, you know, a weird Charlie Kaufman joint that talks about the dawn of the universe, because he can't write a movie that's just about one thing. It all has to be about his brain, and I'm on board. Spike Jones really adequately, like, equips himself as far as getting out of the way and being in service to this very unique script, but also, like, lets it look good and does fun things like recreate his own movie set from being John Malkovich in one scene. For one scene. Just, okay, guys, sure, go for it. I love postmodern bullshit, and I this is the height of postmodern bullshit, and I think it's really quite spectacular. Brian Cox's You Can Make a Movie About Anything monologue is really great stuff, and I don't know, it's... Charlie Kaufman just can't stop flagellating himself in public. He can't stop being mean to himself in his movies. And I eat it up because I relate to that deeply. I relate to having a hard time with your own brain. And I think he does a good job of making his brain relatable to the rest of us. It is adaptation based on White Oleander somehow. Or nice. No, sorry, The Orchid, not White Oleander, The Orchid Thief by, forgot her name. The Meryl Streep's character in this movie. You guys seen Adaptation?
Yes.
Nope.
You got to catch up with Adaptation, man.
It's on the list.
Yeah, it's pretty good.
All right, well, those were 75. We're now moving on to number 74. We're going to have a film I anticipate that will find its way on other lists, I think. List plural, not singular. And that is 1994. More postmodern stuff. Quentin Tarantino's Pulp Fiction.
Nope.
Didn't even make it.
Nope.
No, did it? I'll have to check.
It was a poster in my dorm room in college.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of film lovers have had a Pulp Fiction poster, myself among them.
Yeah, and it was stunning for its time. The dialogue itself was just stunning for its time. And it continues to be a movie that just kind of sits with me because it was one of those early experiences where I'm like, wow, you can do other things with movies.
Yeah.
You can do lots of things with movies. Yeah. And I was 15, because I didn't catch it till it was on the HBO circulation.
Which is probably about the age I was when I first... That's 15 to 18 is sort of when you're supposed to see Pulp Fiction.
Probably so.
Yeah. Your brain's a little...
squishy.
A little squishy and susceptible to its charms.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not to say it's not a charming film. And it's about stuff. I don't think it's a style over substance affair as often gets levied at it. I think there's some there for sure.
Yeah. But that being said, it remains a movie that I really do have a lot of affection for. I don't have any affection for Quentin Tarantino. But that movie still does something for me. And I rewatched it recently, in fact. And yeah, it still works for me.
We're all just trying to be the shepherd, man.
Yeah.
It's on my short list.
Yeah.
It could have made it on another day.
I had to consider it. Yeah. I mean, Jackie Brown is my only Tarantino.
Yeah.
But
Jackie Brown is...
I had to think about...
Man, it's a better movie, really, but...
I had to think about his work kind of holistically. I had a lot of debates with myself about what I was going to do with him.
Here's why Jackie Brown's not on my list.
Okay.
Jackie Brown is a better movie than Pulp Fiction,
yeah,
but it is not nearly as innovative a movie
that's fair.
As Pulp Fiction.
I think that's totally fair.
And so that was the logic for me, I think.
Gotcha. I think Tarantino made my list.
Well... Good.
I think we're and our show's better for it.
The world is better for it. Let's hear your 74, Arthur.
I don't know if it's much better for it. Mine is a transcendental experience of a movie, and that is Terrence Malick's The Tree of Life. For better or worse, in the years since, Terrence Malick has, I think, released more films in the last decade than he did in the previous 40 years combined. And none
Correct.
Of them have been, I think, heralded as good. And so the Tree of Life is really in a weird spot.
There have been defenders. I know his
the newest one,
the newest one,
the German one.
Yeah,
has a lot of people that enjoy that one. I did not. it's just a little too slow and meditative for me. Is Tree of Life pretentious? Yes. Does it have dinosaurs? Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. Those things cancel each other out. I think though. I think it's a transcendental experience about the rigid love of a father and the comforting grace of a mother. Adds a number of spiritual elements to it as well, and just some great performances there from Brad Pitt and the wonderful beloved Jessica Chastain, who is just an incredible actress. I'm glad she finally got her award.
That movie really made her pop.
That was her coming out party.
Yeah. She's just like so ethereal and Jessica Chastain-y.
Yeah.
In that movie.
And she has proven since then she can do a range of things. And so as a coming out party for her, but as just a kind of spiritual experience in front of a screen, I think Tree of Life is a powerful moment. And so that is my number 74.
Though not on my list, it is on my shelf.
Yeah.
It's a great movie. All right, what's your 74, Dalton?
My 74 is a film that I also think is something of a spiritual experience. It is the already mentioned Pan's Labyrinth from Guillermo del Toro. Arthur's got it on his list. I've got it on mine. Arthur mentioned the wine bottle. I'll mention the paring knife. just a moment of screen violence.
I'll
raise
you a slimy toad.
I'll raise you a reverse bloody nose.
Just a guy with eyes in his hands. What a weird movie.
I love
it. What a weird movie. I love it. It's, you know, it somehow manages to be about being a kid while also being about the nightmares of fascism. It's about trying to live a life under the yoke of unimaginable brutality, and is about hope in a hopeless place, and is about the nightmares we can find ourselves in as a child, and the ability for belief and wonder to kind of help get you out of a dark time. And again, is about, you know, gentleness. It's again, it's it, the reason it's higher than something like Nightmare Alley is it's what Del Toro, I think, is best at. Is as much as I like him dipping his toes into the dark, seedy underbelly of Nightmare Alley, I like him when he's being a humanist. I like him when he's saying that life is for living and it's for the creeps and weirdos too. Yeah, I think Pan's Labyrinth is a spectacular film.
It's a great movie. All right, very cool.
Let's shout out Doug Jones. Just really spectacular prosthetic performances in that movie. We probably won't get to talk about that kind of stuff too much on this list.
Yeah.
But I mean that sort of acting is acting, and it doesn't get to do it should. It's really impressive movement work that he does in that film. Yep.
Very cool. Well, we're moving on to number 73. Number 73 for me is considered by Martin Scorsese to be the best film of the 1980s. Fun fact.
Beetlejuice.
It is not Beetlejuice. Jean Juan Tien's The Horse Thief, which I only recently caught up with. And it's a Tibetan film. And so, well, it's Chinese because there's only, but anyway, we had this whole Taiwan China conversation before we started talking a little while ago off air. Same kind of thing. It's set in Taiwan. It's in Tibet. It's the dialogue's in Tibetan, but there's almost hardly any dialogue at all in it. And it's a story of this guy who is kind of it feels very much like a character out of a Scorsese film. He feels very much like a gangster, although it's very rural, almost like a Tibetan Western kind of a situation. And he steals a horse and ends up getting himself in some trouble for that, and has to sort of figure out ways to negotiate life. And there's death that happens with a child in his family, and there's a number of things there. But it's a lot of landscape, a lot of meditation, hardly any dialogue at all throughout the film. And one of the most gorgeous and affecting films that I've sat through in a long time. And it comes, unlike many of those gorgeous and affecting films that usually come in the 2 hour plus mark, this puppy runs at, I don't have the runtime here in front of me, but about an hour and a half, an hour and a half. Probably not quite a tight 90, but close to that. And so, yeah, it's an incredible little film, The Horse Thief. I recommend anyone to check it out and catch up with it. So let's move on. 73 for you, Arthur, is what?
It's a unintentional first of a two-parter from a certain director who's actually going to make the list a few times, I think, this week. And it is Stand By Me. It is a Rob Reiner classic.
Good movie.
To me, it is not a nostalgia thing. I didn't catch up with this until I got to college. It was not one I watched in my youth. So I think it is able to stand on its own by the quality of filmmaking that has crafted it. To me, it is the benchmark of coming-of-age movies. It is the one that is constantly being used to measure anything that comes out since 1986, 87. Thematically, the ideas of friendships don't always last. Childhood is bittersweet. Traumatic things can happen, and we kind of just gloss over them until we do sit and reflect on them. Fun narration from Richard Dreyfuss. It's a movie I really appreciate because almost anybody I recommend this movie to, they really seem to dig it. Again, a testament to, I think, its strengths. It's one I usually have as a selection for my Comp 1 students to watch, do a little movie review assignment. And most of them that pick it very rarely have a negative thing to say about Stand By Me. I think it is just a magical, wondrous, fun, adventurous, tragically beautiful movie.
I've got a spiritual cousin of it on my list, but I'm very, very glad to see it make one of our lists.
Yeah, it's Stand By Me.
It's a good movie. 73 for you, Dalton.
This is one of my more chaotic picks. This is another one of my trying to be with the zeitgeist picks, but I stand by it. It is Denis Villeneuve's Blade Runner 2049, a film that says, you know how Blade Runner was cool? What if it was better?
Oh man!
What if we took
it? Tear my robe.
What if we took? What if instead of arguing about whether or not Deckard were a replicant, we just made a movie where he is a replicant, and that's sort of what the movie's about: is a replicant who hunts other replicants.
He's not wrong.
Thank you, Arthur. Well, yeah, there's no awkward forced kiss between Harrison Ford and Sean Young in this movie. There's no awkward romantic subplot shoehorned into this movie. It is Is it a little long in the tooth? Yeah, it probably doesn't need to be like almost 3 hours long. But I'm glad Warner Brothers gave him a giant pile of money to make it, because God, does it look incredible. The big miniatures in this movie just give the world a tactile feel, give the 2049 Los Angeles a real pulse. It makes it feel like a real place. Not a place I want to visit, but it makes it feel real. And I think Gosling gives his career best performance in this. I think he's astonishing. I think it introduced the world to Ana de Armas, who's really, really, really good in this movie. I guess there is a romantic subplot in this film, but again, I don't think of it as shoehorned in, because it feels so baked into the DNA of this movie, a DNA that is all about, what does your DNA say? Does that matter? Probably not. Is that dog real? I don't know. Ask him. I love this movie about personhood, this movie about subverting expectations, about not being the hero, about not being the chosen special one and making your life mean something anyway. I think this movie is great, and I think about it all the time. What a great score. What a great look. What a weird Lega sequel. It is Blade Runner 2049.
Very cool, very cool. That's done with our 73. As we move on to number 72, I love it when British directors come to the United States and try their trade here, especially if one gets a contract with A24. I'm talking about Andrea Arnold's American Honey.
Oh, okay.
For my number 72. I don't know if either one of you caught this movie.
No,
or not.
This was one I almost caught when it was playing at the Art House Theater in Tulsa, mm-hmm. And I just didn't get around to it.
Man, it's an incredible, incredible film. It begins in Muskogee, Oklahoma, of all places.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah. So there's a little oaky connection right there. But our main character is just running away from home, just trying to find a way to find her own life, you know, and Shia LaBeouf is sort of this kind of carny kind of character, but they're selling magazine subscriptions, and she's just trying to find her way, and through a various set of encounters. I won't say anything more about it to avoid spoiling the film, since it is relatively new, but it's just very, very poignant, very, very personal, very, very feminist filmmaking. Fish Tank is another movie from Arnold that I thought about quite a bit, but what really just doesn't quite work for me as far as a top hundo movie, but it's a movie I like a lot as well, but I think Honey is a better one of the two, and just an incredible American feature from Andrea Arnold at 72 for me. What's 72 for you, Arthur?
As I alluded to, it is a Rob Reiner double feature, because it is Misery.
Ooh, yeah.
I like Misery.
Yeah.
Cool movie.
Misery loves company.
You see my list. I like Misery.
What a movie. Just a masterclass in creating tension, raising stakes, and constantly putting the protagonist in a how's he going to get out of this one situation, as James Caan tries to escape his number one fan, played by the wonderful Kathy Bates.
The incomparable. Yeah, she's so good in this movie.
Comes into the storm picture like a hurricane. Just as some fun work there. For her, James Caan is great playing a cross from her. And Reiner just, you know, it's always fun to see a comedy person do horror. We've talked before about the line and between those two genres that is very similar, very mirrored. But the skill set's usually pretty similar. It's about setting up tension and developing catharsis and delivering catharsis. And Reiner masters that, I think, in Misery. And so that is my number 72.
Hell 72 yeah. For you, Dalton. What do you got?
72 for me is Mary Harron's American Psycho. Mm-hmm. A film that is, I don't know, maybe the best film about the 80s. My favorite film about the 80s, for sure. A decade that I was not alive to see, and I thank the universe for it every day. What a terrible, god-awful time.
It wasn't much to see.
Yeah, I've heard. So I've heard. It seems bad. An American Psycho especially makes it seem terrible. The considered for many years to be unfilmable book from Bret Easton Ellis, a book that I couldn't care less about, because I've heard the movie's better, and I will go ahead and choose to take people's word on that, because Mary Harron delivers the goods in this picture. The big breakout performance for Christian Bale, introducing us to the world's one of the world's finest actors, at least of his generation. I think he's is he a hothead? Yeah, probably shouldn't be yelling at people on set.
Yeah, maybe not super nice all the time, but an incredible actor.
Hey, well, look, if you're a fucking professional, you don't knock stuff over. I'm just kidding. I'm kidding. I this movie is, it's a hard watch. It's not a movie I return to very often because again, while it's very funny, it's got a really great sense of humor. I don't return to it often because it is a difficult watch, but I'm glad it's become such a inextricable part of internet culture. The card meme is brings me no end of joy every time I see it used. It's used so effectively. Because that scene is so effective. The comedy of that scene, as we watch Christian Bale's terror unfold, and what is he so terrified by? These men have better business cards than he does.
Man, yeah.
And he, you know, hits a guy he worked.
Got some VHS tapes to return.
And he's got some VHS tapes that he's made that are deeply disturbing. And that's... There's a lot of movies out there that are about portraits of unwell white men doing nightmarish things to other people, and not many of them are great. This is one of them. This is a film that takes a premise that could very easily be exploitative and makes it empathetic for everybody that ever is on screen. Everybody is given some sort of grace, some sort of humanity, and even when they're vapid and boring and vile, this movie takes them seriously and takes their humanity seriously. And I do think it's an incredible film about ego, about American excess, about violence, and about gender. It is American Psycho.
Very good, very good. That's our 72s. We go now to 71. And for 71, I have a Steven Spielberg joint. I've got Indiana Jones and The Last Crusade.
Whoa, you've got the fedora on here twice. You said it might come back up.
I did.
So you prefer, part three to part one.
I do. And there's more than one time that I consider sequels superior to the originals. And this list will reflect some of that knowledge. But yeah, I knew
you loved Hannibal.
No. That movie, it was a movie I saw very early on. Man, incredible, just short performance by River Phoenix. I love the fun detail of a backstory of how Indy got the scar, for how Harrison Ford got the scar. Basically, because the actor has a scar, they're going to explain it away now.
Yeah.
I think that's just hilarious.
It's kind of good stuff.
And silly and fun. And just the idea of actually pursuing after the Holy Grail. I think Sean Connery is incredible in the film.
We named the dog Indiana.
Come
on. Sean.
It's an adventure film that works on every level for me. I just love it. I do love the sort of father reunite reunion thing that works with it. Zizek makes much of that obscene father stuff with the work of Steven Spielberg, and this is a good example of that kind of work. Mm-hmm. But I think the reconciliation, unlike some of other Spielberg's works, I think we earn that payoff in this particular film. And so, yeah, I'm incredibly just infatuated with that film. Always have been, and always will be. So that's why it's 71 on my list. So what's 71 for you there, Arthur?
It's a good number for Steven Spielberg because it's E.T., the extraterrestrial.
I like that movie.
Good movie.
It is pure magic captured on celluloid is what it is. It is enchanting and fun and lovable.
Every
and
time I touch puppet, a bicycle, that theme song plays.
Yeah.
In my head.
Yeah. Speaking of, you know, great score, obviously that pairing with John Williams, which is almost always a home run for those two.
JW doesn't miss.
Yeah. It's hard. Yeah.
He's good, man.
Yeah, he's.
I'm sure he's got.
He's the best. For
I'm sure he's
reason.
Got plenty of ghostwriters that have worked with him in his career, yeah. But.
Yeah. He's,
wow.
Yeah. Top level guy he is. E.T., though, is just a magical time. I think it is just pure joy in a way a lot of other movies aren't. And obviously, it's important from the Amblin brand as well and kind of setting that tone of what Spielberg's productions would look like for the next 30 or 40 years. But yeah, it's just one we did on the show a few years ago, and I was a bit hesitant to watch E.T. and then to rewatch it and just be swept away by the magic of it and how much life and emotion that little alien puppet brings with it. It's filmmaking at its best, and it's E.T., the extraterrestrial.
Very good, very good. What comes in at 71 for you, Dalton?
Unfortunately, we don't have a third Spielberg movie. We can't. I know.
It cannot be that much kismet.
Threw it off.
No, not enough kismet, unfortunately. And I can tell you this, not a feel-good movie. It is Lynn Ramsey's You Were Never Really Here.
Ooh, no, not a feel-good movie at all.
No, Dustin has picked the anti-John Wick and Pig. I have picked the anti-Taken. A movie that asks the question... What if Joaquin Phoenix were in a Avenging Angel movie? And the answer is, it's sad. It's very sad. Joaquin Phoenix doesn't smile. I'm kidding. I'm sure he'll get to be.
He does when it's painted on.
Yeah. Hey, there you go. I'm sure. What's that? Come on, come on. Is that the movie? Yeah, I heard he gets to be happy in that movie. That's nice. He's not happy in this movie. Nobody's happy in this movie. It is a deeply sad film about trauma and violence. And because I like movie violence a lot, this movie speaks to me because it takes the scenario that we see in so many films like Taken or anything else. It says, what if a real person had to really be the guy that rescued people from human trafficking? That's a fun, you know, scenario for an action blockbuster, sure, but is it really a fun scenario? Should we really be making movies about that? How would that really feel to be involved in that situation? And the honesty of feeling in this movie is so profound. There's a moment where Joaquin has killed a guy and is mortally injured a guy, and that scene is so powerful and takes violence so seriously and manages to take this premise we've seen so many times in so many movies and turns it into something wholly unique and wholly real. And I just think it's an incredible film that more people should catch up with. It is You Were Never Really Here. Dustin, what's your number 70? Or were you about to say something?
No, that was it. I was going to say, that was 71s. Now we're doing 70s. Okay. I'm just sort of just keeping everyone caught up with us.
I wasn't sure if you had any thoughts on You Were Never Really Here, other than it's sad.
It is very sad. And I do find it to be kind of the anti-Taken in that, you know, Pig is the anti-John Wick in that it refuses to play into the game of violence. This is sort of like that shadow side to violence. Rather than romanticizing the violence, it shows all of its ugly truth. And I think that's why it's better than a Taken movie and why that film really works.
Well, it does like really clever things about like the viewership of violence, right? Mm-hmm. It uses CCTV cameras.
The surveillance state kind of stuff with it, yeah.
In its opening sequence, it really kind of very cleverly uses the remove two times over from violence, like we see in something like Henry Portrait of a Killer. It uses that very clever idea to look at violence and just such an effective way. Sorry, I got derailed talking about the movie I like again.
Totally fine.
Let's get back to number 70s.
Okay, so number 70 for me is a film from 1972 from the Soviet Union. It's Andrei Tarkovsky's Solaris.
Okay.
I like the movie a lot. I don't like it as much as some other Tarkovsky films, but it's a movie that I really do appreciate, and it's one I'm more likely to come back to despite its incredibly long 2 hours and 47 minute runtime. But I like it as the anti-2001.
Yeah.
I probably like 2001 better. Hint, hint, nudge, nudge. But that being said, it is an interesting spiritual film. I love the recreation of Rembrandt's The Prodigal Son. That works at the end of it, that it becomes a science fiction film that's really about family, about grace and forgiveness in a way that's really, really powerful. And so, we did it for the show not very long ago, and I still like it a lot. Is Tarkovsky's Solaris coming in at number 70 for me. What's 70 for you there, Arthur?
It's already been mentioned in passing because it's... younger brother made Dalton's list, and it is James Cameron's The Terminator. A movie that in every way works in its own right as a horror thriller, as the monster just does not stop pursuing his prey. And again, Linda Hamilton, great here. Arnie, it's a perfect casting of Arnie.
Yeah.
Cameron really knows how to use Arnie, I think. And it shows here again in a movie that's $6 million to make and just does gangbusters. And then we get Terminator 2. So many iconic images, much like RoboCop. The Terminator vision is always a hoot as well. Him appearing naked in an alley great introduction.
Yep.
To the T-800.
I mean, there's a reason they did it again.
Yeah.
It's a cool, introduction. Sequence. Yeah.
It's a great bit. And I mean, just the unstoppable monster is a fun device. And when it looks human, makes it even more, I think, imposing and scary. And it's, I think in many ways, Cameron's simplest film. And it's still very effective and very affecting. And paves the way for a career that is unparalleled in many ways. And so that is James Cameron's The Terminator.
Very good, very good. What comes in at 70 for you, Dalton?
It is the already referenced cousin of Stand By Me. It is John Singleton's Boys in the Hood. Mm. What a fucking movie.
Mm-hmm.
John Singleton gone too soon. He really was... he was gearing up to enter a new phase of his career, and we just didn't get to see it, and that's a damn shame, because... We've talked about first features already on this show. What a first feature. You know, it's not without its warts, but it just is. They either don't know, don't care, or don't show what goes on in the hood, man. And just great performances across the board. You've got the coolest movie dad of all time, Furious Styles.
Yes.
You've got the one of the best movie best friends of all time, Ice Cube's Doughboy. Like, it's just such a good movie. That, again, you know, kind of took Hollywood by storm and ushered in this whole era of quote-unquote urban life movies, or what, you know, whatever bad way studio executives had of talking about these movies in the 90s, because, you know, there were some very unpleasant conversations had in boardroom meetings trying to ape off the success of this film. And there's just nothing that quite reaches its highs. Miss Society's good. I mean, don't get me wrong, it's another good movie, but Boys in the Hood is just kind of working on another level. And again, it knows its cinematic pedigree well. Like, it you know, Singleton is making direct references to I almost called it Come and See Stand By Me. He's making direct references to Stand By Me in that opening. You know, he is drawing a parallel between life in South Central Los Angeles in the late 80s to this sort of chaotic life of growing up in the 50s, unsupervised, and is sort of drawing these connections. And I just think it's such a smart, well-drawn portrait of human living. It's Boys in the Hood.
Very good. That was our number 70s. Now we move to number 69.
Nice.
Someone was going to do it, I'm sure. Number 69 for me is another A24 film from last year.
Oh, wow.
As well. David Lowery's The Green Knight, already mentioned the last episode on Dalton's list.
Yes.
As I recall. I love The Green Knight. I mean, I love the original poem itself. I teach it every however often I teach Brit Lit 1, although Arthur's got the turn this time, so he gets the chance to teach it. But it's an incredible poem anyway. It's an amazing little bit of Arthurian fantasy, reimagined and rejiggered in a way that is entirely narratively distinct and irreverent to the source material, and yet entirely faithful to the thematic thrust of that source material. I don't know how you're able to thread that particular needle, but Lowery does it. Mm-hmm. And Dev Patel gives an incredible performance on top of all of that.
Yep.
So I like that movie a lot. It is the definitive of cinematic version, as it is the only cinematic version of that story that I know. I've never seen it.
There's a Sean Connery one.
Is there a Sean Connery Green Knight movie?
Yeah. I think he is the Green Knight.
Oh, well.
I could be wrong.
So, well, he's barely in the poem. If it's Sean Connery, he's got to be, like, in the movie the whole time as the Green Knight.
How cool does the Green Knight look in The Green Knight?
Oh, man, super, super cool. Sword of the Valiant, huh?
Yeah. It's a Gawain movie.
Huh. Go figure.
Yeah. Anyway.
Well, that's a thing.
It's a movie that, The Green Knight is a movie that could make my list, I think, in a few years. I was very high on it last year. I think time will tell where that stands for me.
I almost talked myself out of putting it in my list because of the recency bias and because I've got a handful of 2021 movies in my list, but I couldn't stop myself. It just looks so good.
And it just works. It just works for me.
I agree.
So what's number 69 for you, Arthur?
Man, I unintentional with this, another double feature here, this time from Jimmy Cameron. It's Titanic.
Really came very close to making my top 100.
For a long time, this, I think, was my number one on Flickchart when I was doing my initial ratings, just because of the algorithm.
Oh, right.
You
know,
you mentioned the other day, or last week. But Titanic, you know, it's one of those movies, it's just the cultural phenomenon when it came out. just selling out theaters for weeks on end. Unparalleled success in that regard, I think.
I traumatically remember the sellout of theater
run. Oh, I bet
run.
You do. I remember going standing room only in a small theater in Stillwell, Oklahoma, where it played for weeks in a one-screen theater.
Wow. Yeah, and I was working. It was, man. It
I
was
bet
madness.
It was. I can't
madness.
Imagine. You had to open up extra screens just to get it on, probably.
Well,
right?
And we did three-peats.
Yeah.
And 3-peats for a 3-hour movie.
Yeah, it's a long night.
It's a long night.
It's a long night. But man, again, it's, I think, Cameron at his best. It is him toying with this fascination of his pursuit of the underwater, which we see kind of throughout his career. It is his fascination with technology and advancing technology so he can tell the stories that he wants to tell, a theme that will come back again in 2009 when he does Avatar, which took so long because of that and has taken so long to get to a sequel because of some of that.
He just can't stop making movies underwater.
And it's a guy that you can never count out. People want to count James Cameron out every time.
I do, every time.
And then he bats a home run, grand slam, every time. And it's fascinating. And as much as, you know, part of me hates myself for putting Titanic on this list, but it is a good movie.
It's an incredible movie.
Leo and Kate are fantastic. The wonderful Phantom himself. Why can't I think of Billy Zane? Billy Zane.
I love that you called him the Phantom himself. Well, yeah. I mean, yeah, perfect.
I was trying to buy time to remember his name.
gives the great St. Crispin speech in Tombstone.
Yeah.
That's what he I was does. Thinking.
Incredible eyebrows in Titanic.
He
looks great.
He's a beautiful man.
But yeah, he sure is.
But man, just such an epic.
Yeah.
The last American epic.
Wow.
I mean,
you couldn't have said it better.
Yeah. This is what I think about that. I mean, two VHS is a 2V8 is a double VHSer is what it was. It's Titanic, 97, the last American epic. There, I said it on this date, June 13th in the year of our Lord 2022. Dalton, what is your number 69?
My number 69 is another Denis Villeneuve joint. I just can't get enough of that French Canadian cutie. It is Arrival. You're all lucky. I had to talk myself out of. Oh hell yeah! I'm glad to hear that. I had to talk myself out of putting a third Denis movie on this list. This will be the last time he comes up because I stopped myself from putting Dune on the list. The movie's not done yet. There's another half of a movie to come out. I got to see how it all pays off. And my newfound love of the Dune universe wasn't enough to make that movie make the list. But I think Arrival is just spectacular. It's first contact with other intelligent life is a well-trod ground as far as science fiction storytelling goes. It's maybe one of our favorite storytelling or science fiction stories is the idea of first contact. And this film navigates it in a way that is grounded in human feeling, is grounded in human unknowing, is grounded in our fear of the unknown, our fear of each other. And it just looks and sounds incredible. It really is a filmmaker who's never made a bad looking movie, but maybe this may very well be his best looking one. Mm-hmm. I think the design of the heptapods, the aliens that humankind encounters, is really great. The design of their ships is really great. Kind of Geiger-y sort of blank spaces, these cavernous walls. But again, it's all grounded on Amy Adams' performance and this tale of loss that she's experiencing in split timelines. And again, it's a really clever little magic trick of a movie as far as its structure goes, as far as its narrative device goes. But even outside of that, I think it works so well, especially on second viewing. Like, once you understand how the movie is unfolding, it works even better. And again, I find it so moving and so powerful. And the idea of committing to a journey when you know the ending will break your heart is a powerful idea. And I think it's something that anybody, whether you are in a long-term partnership or you have children, anybody who loves has had to think about that idea a little bit. And I think Arrival articulates it powerfully and wonderfully. That is my number 69. Dustin, What's your number 68?
Number 68 is going to be a downer, I'm afraid, friends. Uh-oh. And I'm picking this film. I love it a lot. And a lot of people love a different film from this filmmaker. Chantel Ackerman's No Home movie. And
I've heard of this.
Jenny Dielman is the movie that a lot of people talk about. And Jenny has got a longer title to it. It's got her address and what she does with the camera with that particular film. But I, for my money, I guess I'm just more of a 21st century guy, I guess. And so and that's a movie that dates back in the 1970s.
The other one?
Jenny Dielman.
For a 70s film?
Yeah, 70s gotcha. Film. No Home movie is avant-garde experimental film. It's sort of like an Agnes Varda movie in many ways. And she's very much a cousin to Agnes Varda. And Agnes did not make my list, unfortunately. I could have put The Gleaners in My Eye somewhere in here. But I don't think the algorithm pulled it up, honestly.
You would have had to go looking for Agnes, I'm sure.
Probably so. But No Home Movie.
Did you have to go looking for No Home Movie?
Maybe I did.
Yeah,
I did the experimental film genre for some of it and try to get a bunch of movies in there. But there's so many of them that I had never seen, so it kind of got mind numbing.
That's cool
for a
that
while.
There's so many on Flickchart, though.
Yeah, there's a lot of them there to be found. But anyway, No Home Movie is a documentary in which it is mostly divided up with conversations that Chantel Ackerman has with her mother, Natalie, who is an Auschwitz survivor. And so stories about that, just about growing up, about childhood, about mothers and daughters. And towards the end of the film, her mother passes away. And so she has to sort of find a way to bring that film to some kind of closure. There's an intermediate scene towards the sort of middle two-thirds of the film of the desert to sort of help us sort of wrap our minds around that particular bit of sadness. And sadly enough, though, Ackerman never did. She suffered from depression for quite a while, and completing the film probably resulted in her eventual suicide the same year. So it's desperately sad in that way.
Yeah.
But it's also like this little time capsule of just love and grief and also mental illness and also genocide and majors like societal evil and just a tough old broad from Belgium looking at Chantel's mom. Mm-hmm. And so it's really a bittersweet watch, but it's powerful. It's a powerful film.
That was incredible.
I like that movie a lot. So that's 68 for me. What's 68 for you, Arthur?
Not nearly as emotionally powerful as that, I'm sure. It is M. Night Shyamalan's The Sixth Sense.
Ooh, okay.
Which is, it's a good movie.
Pretty emotionally powerful.
Probably a little bit, maybe. I still think it might be his best film. Pretty close to Unbreakable, maybe.
It's it or Unbreakable, it,
yeah. Yeah, it's neck and neck there. It's a movie that became a meme because of the ending in many ways. But it is a movie that still holds up despite knowing what the ending is, what that big reveal is. It doesn't matter. Because once again, Toni Collette does a lot of hard work to carry a movie to completion. Actually, it's Bruce Willis is doing great work. Haley Joel Osment doing great work. Toni Collette not getting to do a lot of stuff other than be a worried, sad mom. Mm-hmm. It's a good time. It's just a solid suspense film, and it really gives credence to why many were calling Shyamalan the next Hitchcock and the next Spielberg. Because of the skill he had behind the camera. And it is, I think, just as impactful and good today as it was when it came out. And that's The Sixth Sense.
Very good, very good. What's 68 for you, Dalton?
My number 68 is a film of great historical significance, and I'm not being sarcastic. It is 1968's Dawn of the Dead, or not Dawn of the Dead, I'm sorry, Night of the Living Dead from George A. Romero.
Yeah.
What a motion picture. God, it's responsible for every zombie thing you've seen. Yep. I mean, you can go back to White Zombie. There's plenty of precedent for zombies as movie monster. Mm-hmm. But as far as what we think of when we think of stories about the undead, undead cannibals, it comes back to Night of the Living Dead, a film that is socially conscious without really meaning to.
By accident.
Good job, George. Way to do it. But you know,
like all white men, he just stumbled into greatness.
He tip his hand every once in a while at interviews, and he would kind of fess up every once in a while. Be like, I mean, yeah, we kind of knew we were making a choice. Like, but he was always very, diplomatic as far as just being like, we cast a great actor.
Yeah.
And our great actors are the reason this movie works. It has nothing to do with our choices. And I think that is very humble. And that's something that I've always thought is cool about George, is he stayed humble. He stayed punk rock. He always stayed an independent filmmaker at heart. And that's hard to do, especially when you keep having successes and nobody will give you a chance because your movies are too violent and too weird. What a great movie. I don't think that there's anything more I need to really say about it. More will be said about it. Good. I'm glad to hear it.
All right. Very good. Very good. Moving on to number 67. 67 for me is Akira Kurosawa's Seven Samurai. Love that movie. It's incredible. Toshirô Mifune gives probably one of his best performances. I guess Rashomon might come close to the same level and caliber of performance, but it is the urtext of the samurai film of the 1950s. It becomes the bones of the Magnificent Seven, which actually spawns a franchise of three or four different movies that follow after that. And love Seven Samurai, and just that whole samurai culture stuff that was coming out of Japan throughout its filmmaking history. But really, there was a moment of this in the 1950s where these Eastern Westerns started coming out. And so love Seven Samurai. It's very long, but it's really, really good.
We'll talk about it again.
Good. I'm glad to hear that. Moving on then, what is your 67, Arthur?
It is my next entry from those Coen boys, and it's another musical movie. That is Oh Brother, Where Art Thou? Their Southern Odyssey
I'm
film.
A fop.
I'm a Dapper Dan man. I don't want fop. God damn. I'm a Dapper Dan man. And this place is geographical oddity. 2 weeks from everything. Oh Brother, Where Art Thou is a great movie. Just a fantastic comedy filled with a who's who ensemble. The trio led by George Clooney, including one John Turturro, who is wonderful, and one Tim Blake Nelson, who is also wonderful.
Oklahoma's very own.
With appearances by John Goodman, who is also wonderful. It is a movie that...
And a little Holly Hunter, too, just to make sure it's got
just a little dash.
Just all the wonderful people.
Just a little dash of Holly Hunter.
You could always use more.
It is a movie that completely revitalized a entire musical genre in the mainstream in bluegrass music, thanks to those Soggy Bottom Boys, because it is some mighty fine picking and a singing. It's a wonderful movie. I think it is truly incredible. Again, getting into some of those religious themes that the Coens like to put in there with their Jewish ancestry and heritage, and that comes through in Oh Brother, Where Art Thou. I think about it a lot for a variety of reasons, and I can't say enough nice things about Oh Brother, Where Art Thou at number 67.
I'm so glad we got a Coen's comedy in here, because I don't think I have any on my list, despite some of them coming close. Yeah, great pick, Arthur. My number 67 is the already mentioned, already beloved, and already bought for a dollar, RoboCop from Paul Verhoeven.
I buy that for a dollar.
Who among us wouldn't pay a dollar for RoboCop, I ask? Arthur's already said so many great things about it. I'll reiterate those juicy, juicy squibs. Good God. And a truly, truly fabulous performance from Peter Weller. Nancy Allen, too. Nancy Allen's great in this.
Yeah.
A really great...
Miguel Ferrer's pretty good, too.
You know what? Yeah. Honestly, everybody top to bottom is showing up and knows what kind of movie they're in. And I don't know. It's a cheap little grimy action movie that really has a lot on its mind. And for whatever reason, Paul Verhoeven was able to make a handful of Hollywood action blockbusters that really had a lot going on under the hood. And... again, it's just like with Terminator, much imitated, much attempted at replication, and it just can't be done. They've gone back to the board with RoboCop countless times, and they just, I say countless, it's like four or five, right? Like two sequels and a reboot.
Sounds right, yeah.
Yeah, they can't.
I saw the reboot.
TV show, I think, too, right?
That sounds right, but I don't
think
it is.
Pretty sure
it
was a TV show.
There was an incredible Nintendo game.
Yeah,
and there's also that Terminator versus RoboCop game. I play that one. Yeah, you don't know about this? We'll talk about this off air. We don't have time to get into Terminator versus RoboCop. It's a great movie. We'll talk about Verhoeven again on this very episode, in fact. So I'm just going to go ahead and end it and say, Dustin, what's your number 66?
Number 66 comes in from one kid from the Bronx, Little Italy in New York City.
Oh, is it Marty Pills?
Little Marty Pills. It is a movie called The Departed. The one that Leo should have won his Academy Award for.
Yeah, I'd say it's fair.
Yeah, and again, incredible, incredible film about the Irish mob in Boston. It is also a remake of an Asian film of the same title.
It's a Japanese film. Infernal Affairs.
Infernal Affairs, yeah. And so it's an incredible, incredible little film, and just... there's not an ounce of fat on it, despite its long run time. And stellar performances. Jack Nicholson is incredible. And it's just a good time to be had by all.
I'm an idiot. It's a Hong Kong movie. I said that and I was like, wait a second.
I just like, yeah, you said
Andy
Japanese.
Andy
I'm like,
Lau, duh.
I was like, I thought it was.
No, I'm a fool.
Okay. But
listen to Dalton's The Takeaway.
I was going to go with it. I love The Departed a lot. It's a movie that I can always be watching, and that's part of why I like it so much.
It's kind of like infinitely rewatchable in that way that Marty gangster movies are.
Yeah.
There's just something, it goes down smooth.
Mm-hmm.
Also, I think about Alec Baldwin saying, how's your mother? Grace died from fucking my father. That's hilarious. Mm-hmm. I think about that a lot. That's a good line.
So funny.
Just a bunch of good shit talk in that movie.
Yeah, there is.
Really, really lovely.
And Mark Wahlberg's surliness is a whole nother level.
Top four Mark Wahlberg performance, hands down.
All right, well, moving on. What is your 66 there, Arthur?
My number 66 is the first appearance from the Master of Suspense on my list, and that is Alfred Hitchcock's The Birds, which I just think is fantastic. I think it's maybe in his, four to four and a half star tier of filmmaking. I don't think it's the five-star masterpiece, but I think it is just incredible. Some fantastic images as Tippi Hedren sits on that bench and those birds begin to surround her is a great image, and ends in this just sadly torturous moment in a house, sad because of the way that Hitchcock treated Tippi Hedren in filming that movie. And so it does have the weight of that on it. But it is still very affecting, very interesting, based on a story by Daphne du Maurier. So it has some, I think, gothic DNA in it there as well, which is fascinating. It's fun for all that it withholds. Why are these birds doing this? We don't know.
We don't know.
It doesn't matter. They are here to torture us, and sometimes nature just does that.
They're dinosaurs. You can't trust them.
You can't trust a modernized dinosaur.
There's no such thing as birds.
Yeah, look, I don't...
Birds are fake.
These zoomers are onto something with this whole birds aren't real thing. Birds are definitely real, but their distrust of birds is well-founded.
That's very fair. So number 66 for me is... The Birds.
Though we won't see The Birds again, we will see The Master of Suspense again.
Multiple times, yes.
Multiple times.
Dalton, what's your number 66?
Well, speaking of filmmakers who are already mentioned in this extravaganza, it is that little nasty French provocateur himself, Gaspar Noé's Climax. Yeah, that's right. I got another dance horror movie on my list, because I love dance movies, and I like it when they're scary. Climax is a freaky film that I... saw one time by myself at 11 p.m. and I think about it all the time. I saw it after watching, I want to say, Split? That came 2018? Yeah, probably Split. Anyway, I caught something with a handful of folks at the theater, and everybody's left and talked about the movie for a second. I said, all right, I'll see y'all later. I'm going to go watch another movie. And it was Climax.
That's a good night.
The LSD-fueled movie about France, maybe, about French history, I think, about sex, about love, about distrust, about aggression, about
urban legends.
About urban legends, sure. I just think it's a spectacular movie. I love it. I love the way it looks. I love the way it moves. I love the dancing in it. I love how scary it is. Mm-hmm. I love how kind of bleak it ends up being, and yet like still sends you out having a nice time despite its pretty dour ending. There's nothing to be gained or learned from Climax. It's kind of got a real burn after reading ending where so what did we learn? I don't know. Don't do it again, I guess. But I just think it's a great film, and I can't wait to watch it again. It's one that's been on my rewatch list since the first time I watched it. Dustin, what is your number 65?
Number 65 for me is the only representative of the Czech New Wave, and it is Jamil Gyrus's Valerie and Her Week of Wonders.
Okay.
What if Alice in Wonderland was directed by F.W. Murnau? That's this movie.
Cool.
I mean, that's the pitch line. It's cool. Alice in Wonderland, but it's vampires, and so super surreal, super super dark. It's also about puberty, menstruation, maturity, and a little bit about the repressiveness of society in general in the Czech Republic, or well, Czechoslovakia at that time, and an incredible representative of the Czech New Wave. I like Daisies a lot, too, but Daisies is just not a movie I come back to nearly as often as Valerie and Her Week of Wonders. And so for the representative there, I picked that film, and it comes in for me at 65. What comes in at 65 for you, Arthur?
Mind is another game-changing film from 1999, and it is The Blair Witch Project.
We'll talk about it again.
Yeah, I assume we might. It is one of the great horror films. It's one of the great films of 99. It's one of the great films of the last couple of decades.
The best found footage movie?
Probably, yeah. It's pretty close. There may be a couple of light contenders, but it's near the top of the list, if not the top of the list. To tap into much of the same way that Texas Chainsaw does. Mm. Cultural mythos and folklore, and to use that as marketing is so clever. And the faux making of stuff, and this faux history, and the broadcasts, and the way people bought into it, hook, line, and sinker, is magical in a way that it's hard to capture now in an era where we have to be so much more wary of what we find and see on online and on the news and in TV. So it feels kind of like an echo of a past naivete of content consumers, of people watching stuff in that way. And so it just game changer, so economical and so amateur and raw, but really a perfect storm of a movie, and that is The Blair Witch Project.
Very cool, very cool. What comes in at 65 for you, Dalton?
It is the already mentioned by you, Dustin, Louis Buñuel's The Exterminating Angel.
It's a good movie.
It's a cool movie, man. Yeah, it just, there's not a whole lot like it. I mean, it's been imitated because it's so cool. One of my favorite Buffy episodes is based on this movie. And again, I just think it's spectacular. This dinner party that can't end because, well, if it ended, we'd have to admit that there was a problem, then, wouldn't we? And that sort of is the thesis statement of this movie, is there is something rotten at the core of modern society, and if we stop, we have to address the problem. And so we simply won't stop. We'll just keep going on until we're all fucking dead, probably. Mm-hmm. That is The Exterminating Angel. What else is there to say about it?
That's excellent, excellent, excellent. Also equally nihilistic in its opening, but more hopeful by the end, is the second entry from Alfonso Cuarón, coming in at 64 for me, and that is Children of Men.
We'll talk about it again.
Yeah, we will.
It's
the second movie to make all three lists. The third movie, thank you.
And that long, long single take shot of a battle sequence, the whole Mary and Joseph of it all, the fact that the movie itself is so prescient of many issues that we continue to face to this very day. It is an incredible bit of filmmaking and one movie that I love a lot, and I will save my material because we'll talk more about it later. So what comes in at 64 for you, Arthur?
It is the aforementioned Night of the Living Dead.
Yeah, baby.
Dalton already hit all the high points about it. It's top 10, one of the most important movies of the last 60 years. It's legacy.
It's responsible for the AMC network making money.
Yes. Before there were dead walkers, before they were 28 days after the fact, before Zack Snyder got a hold of a franchise, it was George Romero who just put together I'm a big fan of Perfect Storm movies.
Yeah.
And this is one that everything just hit the way it was supposed to. And it has left a legacy that is still referenced, still pivotal, still important today. And so I'm not a zombie guy. When I watch horror movies, the zombies aren't something I'm particularly have an affinity for. But I think Night of the Living Dead is just a upper echelon horror film and film in general.
We'll talk about its legacy again on my list.
Yeah.
Very good, very good. What comes at 64 for you there, Dalton?
It's another Paul Verhoeven joint. It is Starship Troopers, the movie that predicted the Bush administration. I don't know how does he do it, Paul? How do you do it, buddy? Living through fascism, probably, and knowing that history tends to be, well, it's like poetry, it rhymes, as Georgie Porgy would say. I just love this movie. I think it's so funny. I think it looks so cool. I think the fact that the bugs, the mix of puppetry and CGI that are used on these bugs, the fact that it still holds up all these years later is really remarkable, because there's some pretty dodgy 1997 CGI out there. And I just think that the effects in Starship Troopers look incredible. He just took this cast of cuties and put them in. He took a bunch of 90210 looking ass goobers and said, I'm going to put you in a movie about fascism. And it's genius. There are some who would say that the love of this movie is a little overhyped. The movie is not quite as smart as it thinks it is. I would say that's fair. Its critique is pretty limited. But as far as looking at military societies and asking about their utility and their value, it definitely begs you to consider the question of what is all of this killing good for? Even if you can say that your cause is ideologically just, what is it all for at the end of the day? And it does all that while still having Casper Van Diem jump on the back of a giant bug, shoot a hole in it, and then drop a grenade in it and get covered in bug guts. That's cool, man. It's got Michael Ironside's just giving a career defining performance as gruff guy, the thing he did a million times, and maybe never did he do it better than in Starship Troopers as Ratchak. Seriously, one of the great Michael Ironside's performances. Mm-hmm. So if nothing else, it's got that going for it. I love this movie a lot. It came to me early in my life and has stayed with me for many years, because as I grew, so did my appreciation and my understanding of the text. It is Starship Troopers. Dustin, what's number 63?
Number 63 is another Louis Boonwell, so very close to your repeat of Boonwell for Exterminating Angel, but this time it's Los Olvidados.
Okay.
From 1950, one of his Mexican films. And I love this movie because it is very much him striking out into the realm of Italian neorealism, but still remaining a surrealist, and showing I think the inability of neorealism to really capture the life of these young orphan street kids that he's following in Mexico through the course of the film. And so it's got an incredible amount of style. It feels in some ways like a remake of his Land Without Bread, one of his second film that he makes in 1930 about Spain. But it's more narrative and more accessible for that reason. And honestly, I think it's more coherent than Land Without Bread. And so I guess Land Without Bread is his third film. I did accounting in my head just then. Anyhow, Los Olvidados is an incredible piece of filmmaking. A dog runs off with a hand in its mouth, a human hand at one point. And that is gruesome. Something that gets picked up in some zombie films from time to time. And that's where that comes from. So Los Olvidados comes in at 63 for me. What comes in at 63 for you, Arthur?
Well, 63 for me is an experimental film in its own right.
Yeah.
And it's one that asks the question, is Adam Sandler a good actor? And it's one that answers the question, yes. It is Paul Thomas Anderson's Punch Drunk Love.
We'll talk about it again.
It is just good movie. Incredible film from PTA about love and anger and mental health and family and family dynamics and social dynamics and all of that can come together in a very frustrating and oft sometimes ugly package. And I think I'll wrap it up right there. That's that, Mattress Man. Dalton, what is your number 63?
A writer writes a novel, a songwriter writes a song. We do what we can do to endure. It is David Lowery's A Ghost Story. I love David Lowery, man. There's a reason he's on my list twice, and he's only, what, 10 years into his filmmaking career? He makes movies, man. He makes pictures that I like, and I like A Ghost Story a lot. It's a film about death. It's a film about grief. Does it unfortunately star Casey Affleck? Yeah, but he's under a sheet for most of it. Rooney Mara eats a whole pie. That's wild.
Rooney Mara does eat a whole pie.
In real time.
What a scene. That's movies, baby. God, that's cinema. I love it. This kind of elliptical, meditative, timey-wimey movie that takes us all the way to the end of time and back again. It is just about what we do to endure. It can come across a little pretentious at times, but what movie doesn't? I think even the dumbest have their moments sometimes, and this movie is certainly full of pretension, but I think it equips itself pretty masterfully as far as being a story about grief that doesn't take itself too seriously, because again, a ghost is under a sheet, is a sheet. There's a person, there's a sheet with eyes cut into it.
Right.
Such a silly movie. And yet it is so,
totally works.
So good. I'll read one more, from the house party scene. I think it's kind of the set piece of them. It's the midpoint of the film. We build our legacy piece by piece, and maybe the whole world will remember you, and maybe just a couple of people, but you do what you can to make sure you're still around after you're gone. It's a ghost story. Number 62, Dustin, what do we got?
Number 62 is my first entry from one David Lynch.
First Lynch.
Eraserhead.
Lynch.
Yeah, David Lynch.
His first David Lynch.
His first David Lynch.
What did I say?
You said first Lynch.
Oh, his first David Lynch.
Just clarify.
Yeah, that's important to clarify. You're right.
Oh my gosh. I went to a weird place, man. David Lynch's Eraserhead is an incredible film. I don't know what else to say. What's that?
He's a weird guy.
He's a weird guy. And it's a weird movie about how it's kind of horrifying to have children. Can't confirm.
I'm just a little creep from Montana. What's so weird about me?
Right? And we'll be seeing a bit more of the man from Montana in my list, I'm sure. I don't know if I'm going to see Eraserhead again.
He did make it. You know, he tried. Eraserhead's in like the top 150, but gotcha. He didn't quite make the cut.
That's fair. That's totally fair. And Eraserhead is off-putting a bit. I think there's a number of much more accessible Lynch films that one could watch, and so, but anyway, I like that movie a lot, it's an incredible thing. I think Jack Nance's performance is great in this, and it's cool that we get to see Jack Nance sort of work throughout all the rest of Lynch's oeuvre as well. Yeah. And so it's a great movie, and definitely super influential, and but buckle up, Buttercup, because it's gonna get weird with that one. So with that, number 62 for you, Arthur, is what?
Arguably the most transcendent and spiritual experience I've had in a movie theater, and that is Ang Lee's The Life of Pi.
You love this movie.
I love this
movie.
I'm
not surprised to see it make your list.
Life of Pi.
Quite a bit.
I wish I had caught this one in theaters.
It
really
is a massive testament to the power of story and how it helps us cope, how it helps us communicate, and how it helps us to get through hard times and to deal with those hard times. And it is beautifully realized in some very impressive visual magic on screen, and probably some of the best use of 3D that I ever experienced. It's one of those that reaffirmed that maybe only really good directors should work with 3D because there are only a handful of
it's good
ones.
Rule.
I
caught it in theaters, and it was absolutely amazing.
It's him. It's Cuarón. It's Scorsese. and it's Cameron. Those are the only ones.
Yeah, that's fair.
Let's just limit 3D movie, which
else,
I think
no
we have pretty much.
You know,
there are a couple here and there.
It's kind of come and gone. Yeah.
So I'm thankful, but Life of Pi made great use of it, and it's just a magical movie that I love dearly. That is Life of Pi.
Very good. What comes in at 62 for you, Dalton?
It's a ghost story of a totally different type. It's William Friedkin's The Exorcist.
We'll see it again.
Yeah.
I thought we might.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had a feeling that would make all three. Yeah, it is sort of a monumental horror film. Maybe the most successful American horror film of all time. Is there another one? I don't think so. Both in terms of box office and like prestige,
cultural
recognition.
Cachet,
yeah.
Arguments could be made, but yeah.
Arguments could be made. But I think like even what a wild response this movie got it on its initial release, and what a legacy it's had, because it just has stood the test of time as an all-time scare the shit out of you movie. But it is also about, you know, parent-child relationships. It's about faith and science. It's about what do you do when everything is going wrong and there's no logical answer for why your life is not making sense. Again, it's, yeah, we'll talk about it more, so let's leave it at that. Dustin, what's your number 61?
Number 61 for me is another Japanese film. It's the third Japanese film to make the list for me so far. It is Yajiro Ozu's Tokyo Story, which is a really...
A movie I've been meaning to watch for a full 15 years now, I think.
I mean, thematically, it is about kids who are just too busy to take care of their parents. And they don't want to take care of the parents. The parents need to be taken care of. And it's sort of this way in which it's a different sort of cultural question that we might face here in the West, is this idea of you have an obligation because there aren't pensions and a social safety net in this particular situation. And so, yes, this is kind of your job now. They raised you. Now you usher them until they shuffle off this mortal coil, is sort of the expectation. And these kids are like, no, I'm not having it. And
well, not all parents are good.
Well, these are okay. I mean, that's the situation here is that these are okay parents. Not like I owe you a thing. It's just that, no, that'll be, I cannot achieve my, well, Americanized dream because of the American occupation. Because it's 1953. So there's that. Also, Ozu is probably one of the great classical filmmakers. Classical filmmaking really doesn't come out of Hollywood. Mark Cousins makes the argument. It comes out of Japan. And because American filmmaking is romantic. And what Ozu does with his framing and his symmetry and the ways in which he rests in these quiet moments is really something that would really fit the definition of what classical, in terms of classical art or classical music, would fit. And I'm kind of convinced by that case.
Okay.
So that argument works for me. And Ozu's Tokyo Story is, again, an incredibly powerful little film. And, again, raising some interesting cultural questions that are not of my own culture, but what are those obligations? And to think about,
that's a universal consideration.
I think so. Yeah. And so it's a really, really fascinating film. So that comes in at 61 for me. What comes in at 61 for you, Arthur?
Man, I really didn't intend to have three Rob Reiner films on this list. I really didn't pay as much attention to who made the movies rather than what the movie itself was. And so here he is again, but they're all in the section. I think this is the last Rob Reiner on the list. And that is the beloved 1989 comedy, When Harry Met Sally. The benchmark for the modern rom-com in many ways. And it stands the test of time. Billy Crystal, Meg Ryan, just knocking it out of the park as these will-they-won't-they friends who embark on a multi-year will-they-won't-they relationship that culminates on New Year's Eve. And it is wonderful and dynamic and lovely, rife with great moments, including the I'll have what she's having.
I'll have what she's having.
An all-time classic.
I got to sit in Kat's diner and eat at that wonderful diner.
Nice.
Which was mostly driven by how much I enjoy this movie. I think it's one of the greats. It simultaneously, I think, harkens back to a classic era while also having some modern sensibilities about it. And so I really appreciate it. And so it's When Harry Met Sally.
Very good. Very good. What comes in at 61 for you, Dalton? Wrap us up.
My number 61 also harkens back to some classical movies while being decidedly modern. It is Sam Raimi's The Quick and the Dead. I love this movie. It means a lot to me. This is a movie my sister and I grew up watching a ton.
Yeah.
And I think it's just such a great showcase for what Raimi can do as a director.
Yeah.
His camera is not He can't stop moving the damn camera in this movie. Yeah. He doesn't care. It's also got Russell Crowe's first American performance. He's absolutely stunning in this movie. It's got the last performances of Leo, as like Kid Leo.
Yep.
It's got an all-time great Gene Hackman villain performance, and it is like Sharon Stone's blank check. It is the movie that she cashed in her clout on and said, I'm going to make a Western, and I want Sam Raimi to direct it. And
they went to town.
They did. Mm-hmm. God, they make a Western. I think it's the only... I've got some neo-Westerns on my list. You know, I've already mentioned No Country for Old Men, and I think I might have another neo-Western later on my list, but this is the only, like, proper Western on my list, and I think... What makes this movie so fun is it's a Western that cuts out all the boring shit. It says, what if there was a town where gunfighting was what they did?
It was just duels.
Yeah. What if we just take all of the riding horses to places out of the Western and just make it gunfights?
Shoot each other. Yeah.
Yeah. So many good scenes in this movie. The culmination of the flashback arc is so... It sets up such a standard sort of flashback present day structure, and the rug pull that you finally get when the flashback of this movie reveals what it's been withholding from you, it just makes the movie, like the stakes of the movie, that much more exciting. And it makes an earlier moment in the film land even harder. That's just cool filmmaking. Really kind of lights out, good script. I forget the writer on the script, but the kind of fun production history on getting this one out into the world. It's the last Sam Raimi one on my Sam Raimi film on my list, and while I think Spider-Man 2 is probably a much more impressive accomplishment as far as scale goes, this film is just a love letter to Westerns and a love letter to movies. And it is so just I've already not even mentioned the character actors who show up. Keith David, Lance Henriksen, Tobin Bell. Come on. What a movie. It's one of those that just lives with me all the time. And it's been fun to see it sort of get a second life. You know, people are discovering it right now because of its recent coverage on Blank Check. And it's definitely getting, I've got a friend of his made him watch it because of Blank Check. And we were just talking about it the other day. He was like, you know about this movie? I was like, boy, do I know about this movie.
Yes.
Yeah, that movie rules. And here I am to say definitively, it rules so hard. I put it at number 61 on my list of my 100 favorite movies. And that brings us to the end of this episode, I think.
That's right. That's 20 movies apiece. That's 30 movies in total. Dear listener, your syllabus just got much longer.
60.
What'd I say? 60. I don't know what I said, 34, 60. And you can also be part of the conversation. You can correct my math various means. Dalton, tell them how.
That's right. If you want to talk to us about our lists, you can find us on the internet. You can send your long-form feedback to goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. That's the name of the show you're listening to, goodtrashgenrecast@gmail.com. You can also find us on Twitter. We are at goodtrashmedia over there. And you can find links to this show and other stuff we're into. You can also find us on Patreon. It's patreon.com/GTM. If you want to help us keep the lights on, that's patreon.com/GTM. You can go there and get all the information about what you get for helping us out. Mostly it's we'll send you a movie, or you can pick a movie for us to talk about on the show. But we also have a pretty hefty back catalog of bonus content, including, pretty good three or four ARC tabletop role-playing game that we did, an actual play podcast that we recorded for bonus content. There's all kinds of fun stuff over there. That's patreon.com/GTM. This is the part of the show where I would normally throw to Arthur and say, what are we talking about next week? But I know what we're talking about.
60 more movies.
That's right. We'll be talking about 60 through
41.
41. Thank you.
See, yeah, counting's hard when you do it in public, isn't it?
It's weird.
Don't make fun.
I don't want to. I'm sorry. I shook my little hand at you and said, ha ha ha, what an idiot.
But you keep watching and we'll keep talking and we'll see you all next time.